Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, everybody. My name is Vivian. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. And it's my honest pleasure and privilege and honor to be here. And thank you, Polly, so much for having me, not only in your heart, but in being a part of such a beautiful thing that you've created here. And the speakers were off the chain. And I'm so proud to be one among many crazy, insane other people, and we're all together, and I'm just so excited to be part of all that, and it makes me feel good. So thank you for sharing your beautiful stories and your beautiful life with us, and I'm so grateful to see so many old friends and to make some new friends and to reconnect with people. And I was reminded when Donna was sharing her story what an amazing program we have. And the gifts of sobriety and recovery. And many years ago, I called Donna up in another panic mode about something, of little importance as I think back on now. But at the time, it was overwhelming. And she said, just come on out and stay with me. So I got on a plane in South Carolina and went to Palm Springs and hung out there. And she just welcomed me into her arms, into her home, and took me to meetings and just loved me up. And I went to hear her give her story one day, and I have used this ever since. And it's the story about about we alcoholics and how we think. And I think all the speakers prior to this are a prime example of this, including myself. And it's about the infamous dodo bird. And I don't know if you've heard the story or not, but you know the dodo bird flies in ever-widening, ever-diminishing circles, continuing to fly in diminishing circles, to eventually he flies right up his own ass. And and I'd like to say that I qualify for that. And I love that story, and the longer I'm sober, the more I get it. I wake up in the morning, I'm already there. I ask God to direct my thinking, especially asking it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives, and then I hear the pop. And I've had friends of mine tell me they heard it all the way in Cleveland. And, you know, it's just the insanity, because we are crazy, and I love that we know that we're crazy. You see, for so many years, I didn't know I was crazy. But I knew that you were, and it's interesting that transformation of going where you're the crazy and I'm like, okay. So anyhow, a little bit about, you know, my sobriety date is January 3rd, 1994, and as a couple of us, you know, we found it necessary to go back out there and do a few little bit more of research. And so I celebrate 1994 because 1991 didn't really work for me. And I found it necessary because, you see, when I got here, I already had a little home distribution business. And it was very lucrative, and I was doing very well financially with it. But somehow I thought I could do that and not utilize that, it's marijuana maintenance. And and for about 2.5-3 months when I got into the program, I was perfectly fine. Now, you told me when I got here, some of my friends welcomed me into the rooms, and they said, Viv, there's good news and there's bad news. The good news is you're an alcoholic. Well, I didn't like that news. And the bad news is that we're your help. And I already knew some of the people that were going to be my help, and I was really worried then. And so they told me at that point, Viv, get a big book, get a sobriety date, get a home group, and get a sponsor. Now, I don't know about you. I don't know how capable you were of following any kind of instructions when you got here. I came in here wide-eyed and crazy. And, you know, I looked around the rooms going, there's some of my peeps that I haven't seen in a while, and they're sober, and they're happy about it. And, the only thing I did right, and I know it was God's grace, literally, that brought me back to those rooms again and again and again. And the only thing I did right was keep coming back. No matter what you're doing or no matter where you are, if you just keep coming back, eventually you will hear hopefully that pearl of wisdom where one alcoholic identifies with that, with the alcoholic. And that's what happened for me eventually. Well, not at first. So I came into the rooms and you told me to get that, you know, you gave me those little bit tidbits of instructions and you said you need to get a big book. And in the back of the room in our clubhouse, we have all the literature back there. And so when I finally got my act together to literally get up and walk out of here, I picked up the big book and I picked up all the other literature back there and I left with like a whole box load of stuff. And I didn't pay for anything, of course. I didn't know that there was a charge to be a drunk and be sitting in the rooms of AA and have a literature to tell me about what a drunk I was. So I would have to do an inventory around that eventually, and I did make an amends and pay that home group back. But, you know, after sitting in here for about 3 months and not having a sponsor and not having the directions of anybody telling me what I ought to do or not do, a couple of things I recommend that you don't do, one of them is don't do what I did. I didn't ask anybody to be a sponsor. I wasn't so sure exactly what that meant, and I wasn't asking any questions either. I was just really very quiet about this whole thing, and I sat way in the back of the room. And when I finally met up with Michael, she told me that was where the remedial section was. And so I moved a little bit closer eventually when I did get a sponsor, and that would be a couple of years down the road. Because after 3 months of sitting in here getting restless, irritable, and discontent one more time, I picked up the nearest thing, and I knew that drinking was killing me, and I knew that the wreckage of my past revolved around a lot of drinking and a lot of everything else, and there was a whole tragic train of violence and domestic, all kinds of problems that we all come through to get here. And I knew that drinking was a big part of all of that, so I decided that drinking really wasn't the thing I ought to do. And a friend walked up to me and said, "Vivian, this book says Alcoholics Anonymous on it. It doesn't say anything about marijuana in here ever in the big book." And I said, "Fabulous." And so off to the races we went. And then for the next 2.5 years, I kept coming to meetings. Sitting in here, getting further and further to the back of the room and wearing dark glasses and being hip, slick, and cool and thinking there wasn't anything wrong with what I was doing. And, you know, what happened was I had people in the rooms that just loved me no matter what. And they loved me into eventually learning how to love myself. But what they did was just allowed me to occupy a seat in here no matter what I was up to. And I did that marijuana maintenance for a couple of years, and I had to eventually come to that point where I hit my knees in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not drinking, and I'm using this substance. And the only good thing about that is that you really don't care about much of anything. I didn't care that, it just didn't seem like this getting sober was so hard for me when I was doing that. It seemed to kind of eat, that little ease and comfort was a little better around that. Until eventually, it stopped working for me. I don't know if you've ever had that problem, but it eventually just stopped working cold turkey on that. And I hit my knees in the room and wanted to put a gun to my head. And, that's what this disease did for me. Did to me and for me and everybody else around me. And so when I finally got honest about all that, I put down that substance, and it's like God just start putting people in my life. When the student is ready, the teacher appears, and you don't even have to know you're ready. Because I didn't know anything about being ready. I didn't know what I was, who I was, or why I was even here. But God's grace would put me right in the middle of these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the journey would begin for me. And I'm so grateful. Oh, my God, here we go. I'm prepared. I tell you, the longer you sit around in here and you begin to hear the speakers, and like when I was hearing Larsine today after that, I was just like, oh, my God, the dam's opening and it's starting to happen. It's going to happen here. Get ready, kids. I'm so grateful that, all I had to do was just walk into these rooms and nothing more was required of me. And, I can tell you a little bit about what I was like, what happened to change me, and what I'm like today. And I grew up in a family similar to Larsine's. Now, my father was a raging, violent alcoholic. My mother left him, moved to Columbia where I was born to escape, his being in his presence. And, she was physically and emotionally abused for many years. And I never knew the man, to my knowledge, and any time that we mentioned him, it was hushed. We weren't to talk about him. And so all I knew was that I never wanted to be anything like him, and it must have been really horrible for her. And so my whole family moved from New York down to Columbia, South Carolina. I was born there, and I as we heard earlier, if you were here, the Al-Anon speaker, oh, she was so wonderful. The disease of alcoholism was within every one of us at this point. And what happened was, you know, we lived in that household without a dad, and you don't think that you're an alcoholic, as I thought the same thing, that I'm not hurting anybody but myself. But let me tell you, not being present in your kids' lives does hurt everybody emotionally. And I know eventually I would end up doing all the things that my dad did to us. And mostly what he did to us was not be present in our lives. And eventually I would go down that same road and do exactly what he did. And I'm not proud of that, but I know that at the time that was probably the next right thing I could do. And so we lived in Columbia. By the age of 9, I'd already had the last rites 3 times. I had a deformed stomach, and I had a lot of problems with that. So I was in and out of the hospital in a lot of pain, and a lot of things called like paregoric was on a regular basis going into my little body. And I'm pretty sure that trigger was switched right there and then, and I was a raging little alcoholic at about anywhere from 1 to 9. And so increasing dosages of that, the last time I had the last rites. And I'm going to reflect on the things that happened to me as I look back. One of them was the last time I had the last rites. I came to for a few minutes, and my whole family was around the bed, and they were holding hands, and the priest was anointing me, and we were saying the Our Father. And the next thing I remember is I'm coming to, and I'm getting ready to come home from the hospital. I survived. So there's God. There was one of the first God coincidences I'm aware of. I would go on to have it one more. I have the last rites one more time before I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to tell you, when I got here and I crawled through those doors, I did not feel happy, joys, and free. There was none of that going on for me, and I didn't know anything about what was happening with me. And I'm not quite sure how I even got here, except that God kept putting people in my life that would lead me down this path, right through the doors. And thank God, because so many of us don't even get here. And what's the sad part is about 95% of us won't stay here. And we have such a beautiful solution. You know, I know Polly talks about the spiritual, that we have a spiritual malady. The Big Book suggests that we have a spiritual malady, and the only thing that can combat that is a spiritual solution. And we are the spiritual solution. We have the solution, and the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps, takes us into that solution and saves our wretched lives. And so why? Because we can now be of usefulness and whole and able to help another sick and suffering alcoholic when no one else can. And I had already been down the psychiatric path. I was raised a Catholic. I went to parochial schools. I knew right from wrong. I was wrong a lot as a kid growing up. I was always getting into trouble. I was always that little kid that was running around, couldn't sit still, and now they call that attention deficit disorder. And my son has that. Oh, and I love him so much. Oh, my God, I love him with my whole heart. He has 7 years sobriety, coming up on 8. And we'll talk to each other, and we both have attention deficit disorder. And he called me one time from Walmart because he had to go in there and get some tools. And he said, "Dear God, help me." And I said, "Well, what's wrong, honey?" He said, "Oh, I'm in here. I came in here to get one thing here. I've been an hour and a half. I've been up and down every aisle. And a bird came flying over, and I thought of you." And that's how we think. And I get it. And I said, "I totally get it. You know, let a bird come through anything, and I'm on that bird." But my whole life has been like that pretty much. But, you know, there was never anyone in our family that found the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, unfortunately. And our family was ravaged with it. And then we had an Uncle Charlie that would sit around frequently on holidays, and we kids would just, you know, we just turned away and looked away. It's like the head in the sand sort of thing. But his head inevitably would hit the plate at some point on just about every holiday. And we thought that was kind of fun. That was really entertainment for us. And poor Uncle Charlie. And he died of this disease eventually. And so no one in my family has ever found this program, but thank God I was there to be the example for my son. And one day he called me and said, "Mom, I want what you have." And that was after many, many attempts of picking him up off the carpet, bringing him home. You know, I didn't have any Al-Anon in me, unfortunately. That came later. You try hanging around an active alcoholic very long, you're going to do something. One of you is going to get killed. And it wasn't going to be me anymore. So I finally got my butt into the rooms of Al-Anon and learned how to deal with that. And I turned him over to you guys. And it was amazing. You know, he was done. I call that gift of desperation is when you have done enough. When there's nothing left to do and nothing left to say. And there's nothing that anybody can do for you. All you can do is surrender. And that ultimate desperation was when my desperation became greater than my arrogance. And I finally surrendered 100% to you. And that was my gift, and it was also my son's gift. And because I could do that and what you did with me, I could pass that along because he saw what happened for me and to me as a direct result of this program and you beautiful people. Thank you. And so I would go on to have a relatively productive little life after the hospital incidents for me. You know, I grew up and went to junior high school, and in high school I met this man. And as a freshman, I married him right out of high school. I was 18, he was 35. My mom was culling the herd early on. There were six of us kids, and she wanted me out of that house, and I don't blame her. I wanted out of the house. And he was like my sugar daddy, you know. I loved his horse. That was it. It was the horse that got me. And he had this beautiful, gorgeous Morgan, and he would come down there riding that gorgeous horse. And I just fell in love with that horse, and the man on it wasn't bad. And so we got married right out of high school, and I just thought that that was going to fix me. That was going to be the answer to everything. And, you know, after a year or so, I started getting just batshit crazy, and I just couldn't stay in that marriage, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And I thought, well, you know, a kid will help this situation. So we got busy about that. And then I had my son, and that was the most beautiful thing that's ever happened for me. And, I mean, we celebrated the joys of parenthood, and we loved that boy, and I just got about the business of being all involved in him, and I really hadn't been drinking that much, a little bit on the weekends, and it really, you know, my life seemed to be okay. Still untreated alcoholism. And after a little while, then that's not okay. That's not doing it for me either. And then a couple of years went by, and I said, well, I know what we need. We need a little girl now. So we got busy and had another little baby, and now we have two babies, and I am off the chain. And everything I wanted with every fiber of my being was to have that little girl in my life. I already had this beautiful son, and I thought this would be the perfect family now. We'd have that little white picket fence around the house. I had everything I could possibly ever need or want. Every wish was met with anything that I wanted or needed and more. And none of it made me happy. I was completely restless, irritable, and discontent. And what happened was, eventually, I reached a point where I couldn't handle it anymore. And I started drinking on the weekends. You know, my husband worked out of town on the weekends. So I would go out and party with some of my friends, you know, perfectly innocent at first. So, you know, in the beginning, I drank impulsively. You know, once in a while it was good. I really didn't overshoot the mark very much. And occasionally I would get a little tipsy. But it just seemed to be such a progressive thing really fast. And so then I began to, you know, I heard this so well put. I drank impulsively at first. And then it got to the stages of convulsively. And then it became repulsive. And that's my whole drinking career. And then I began to get to a point where I was doing things with people that I didn't need to be doing things with, that didn't involve my family, and certainly weren't accepted socially or by the community or anybody else for that matter, because I was now reaching that point of incomprehensible demoralization, and the party was on. And I know when I did my sex inventory, I had to put down no name, no name, no name, and then it got to pile one, pile two, and pile three. And those are just the things I remember. And I couldn't take my kids down this road with me, and so I made the only right choice one day as I walked out of that marriage and I left those two kids with no more thought than yesterday's grocery list. And I just turned my back and walked away and walked out to pursue, really, alcoholism had me. And I couldn't say no to that any more than I could say no to anything. And I walked right on out that door, and I didn't draw a sober breath until I came to you in 1991. And I drank like I wanted to drink, and I drank and did those things with those people anytime, anywhere, whatever. And I don't know how I survived all that, because I'm a blackout drinker, and I don't remember a lot of it. And thank God, I'm so grateful that I wasn't that Michael talks about not being a blackout drinker. I am grateful to be a blackout drinker. Thank God. And I don't really want to hear about all the details. I have a lot of friends that wanted to tell me the details the next day, and I was like, please. And you know, it's just kind of amazing. And I want to tell you, when I got here, unlike Michael, I was not a prostitute. I just gave it away. I didn't know that you could charge for it. I didn't know that I could make money at that. I know, it's crazy, right? And, you know, so I got on out there and I was doing the deal, and that lasted for years. And eventually, at one point, I had the opportunity to move from Columbia, South Carolina, down to Hilton Heads, which is where I've lived, you know, for many years. And I remember I'd been drinking this every day, and I go to get this truck to move down to Hilton Head, and we go down to where the U-Haul it trucks are, and you know, we're alcoholic, we can't get a small truck, no matter how much stuff you've got, you can't have a small truck. So I go eventually over to the biggest truck they have there, and he throws up the back door, and there's this bum in there, and I said, I'll take him too. And so I get him, I wake him up and bring him around to the cab in the front, and we sit up in there, and we roll up whatever we've got, and we get on the road with a six-pack or several, and down to Hilton Head we come. Now, I don't even know who this was. I'd never ask his name. He never asked my name. We just had a good old time all the way down, and he helped me load everything, unload everything, and off he went. And that's how I live my life. You know, to say it was a safe... It's amazing. So anyway, I got down there and I started setting up a little business. And when I got here, it wasn't so bad for me. You know, at least I kind of measured my outsides, my inside by your outside. I mean, I had a business, I had a car, I had my relationship, I was doing okay. Now, I didn't have anything in my name because when I left Columbia, I had a little wreckage back there. But eventually we got that clear. You know how we are. You know, this trail of tears follows you everywhere you go, and some papers sometimes. And so I got down there. And I want to tell you a little something else about my husband. I'm going to jump all over the place because that's just how it works. But my husband used to, he had a lot of guns. And I'd gotten into the point when I was 18, we target practice. And in the South, you just... You know, that's just leisure time. You go out and you shoot beer cans or whatever. And target practice, we went to the local turkey shoot. I mean, I had a lot of fun, you know. So I started carrying a .357 Magnum with me everywhere I went, to the grocery store, to the wherever, no matter where I went. I had this big, heavy weapon arsenal in my purse. You know, and I didn't think there was anything wrong with any of that. And... I don't know why I had to do that, but I couldn't leave the house without it. And I'd go to the grocery store like I was going to have a shootout in the produce section or something. And, you know, and there's a lot of stuff laying around there. I didn't need to shoot anything. But that was my life. I lived in such abject fear my entire life that I felt that I needed something to protect me no matter what. And, you know, we're just absolutely insane. And thank God nobody could see what was going on in my head and that I had a gun most of the time. Now, when I got to you, I had a meeting in Hilton Head, and it was one of the first few meetings I attended, and we had chairs lined up like this, and they make these little fanny packs that are actually holsters. And so now I'm carrying a 38 because it's not as heavy, and it's just a little more, it's, you know, not as difficult, and it's a little bit more concealable. And so I'm sitting in the rooms of AA now, and we line the chairs up at some of the meetings. Maybe you know what I'm talking about. They put the chairs out, and when you're done, they put the chairs away, and they're at local churches. And so there's only, I'm busy talking to somebody that I hadn't seen in a long time, and I noticed that all the chairs are gone except for my chair. My chair is still sitting right where it was, and underneath is my little fanny pack, and laying out on the floor is my 38, because it had fell out of my purse, and I didn't realize it. People didn't want to mess with that, and they didn't want to mess with me about it whatsoever. You know, and I just saw nothing wrong with any of that. And so there's that complete insanity. And we heard about those things today where we're mental defects and full flight from reality, bodily and mentally different. We suffer from the disease of alcoholism and we don't even know it. There's the crux of not knowing that we're full flight from reality. When I started actually coming to in the rooms and saw that second step where it talked about being restored to sanity, I was utterly amazed that anyone would think that I was insane to start with. But when you look at the incredible insane behavior that I exhibited throughout my life, when I saw my fourth step, I was shattered beyond belief. It was like this was somebody I didn't even know. And thank God I don't have to live like that anymore. But it's absolutely amazing, you know, how the draw here. There was something about the light in your eyes. There was something about the laughter, the levity. And there's just that peace and that serenity that you all have that I didn't have in my life. And I didn't understand any part of that until I got here and just hung around and kept coming back. I just kept coming back. That's the only thing I ever did right. And, you know, eventually I would get into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous when I, about 18 years after I'd moved down to Hilton Head. And I'd finally had someone come to work in my shop, and she had a drinking problem because she drank with me a lot, and I knew she had a drinking problem. And and I'm so grateful that Vicki got into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because she really needed it. And and I thought, if I ever get that bad, you know, and poor baby, she was going down the wrong side of the street one night, and we had been drinking that night, and for some reason I left early, and she continued on, and at 2 o'clock in the morning she ran down the wrong side of the highway and went through two cars and went through the windshield of the second one, and she literally was, her whole face was practically peeled off, and it was an absolute horror. And and this is a small little place, and back in those days I went to the hospital to see her the next day, and it was unbelievable. I'm a hairdresser, so I got to go over there and cut all the hair off of her head that wasn't embedded with glass and blood, and clean her up a little bit. And thank God some well-meaning women from the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous came to visit with her, and she was being whisked away to a 30-day program when she finally could get out of the hospital, and that took a while. And when she went away, she came back, and there was like dark and light. There was an amazing change that occurred with her, and I was absolutely, it was unbelievable. It was like I was looking at a different person. And she started working in my little shop, and nobody would really hire her. She was a little bit, she was known to be crazy, and I was crazy right along with her, but I didn't know that I was just as bad as she was. And so she started working in my shop, and she only said one time to me, "Vivian, if you ever want to go to a meeting, you let me know." And it never occurred to me that I would ever ask that question. Now, here's what happened. I'm at home one night, and you know, after years of drinking the way we drink, and This is a progressive disease. And now I'm drinking more and more, and I'm drinking daily, and I'm drinking, tearing it up on the weekends, and I'm adding all these other little substances. And when I'm drinking, if there's anything else out there that you have that I think might help or enhance this situation, if it'll fit somewhere, it's going in. And so then I went down that road, and I went to another whole dimension of which I can't even explain or describe. And so what happened for me is that eventually I'm drinking when I don't want to be drinking. I don't know if you had that happen for you, but it's just one day I woke up and says, I'm not drinking today. Today I'm just not going to drink. And I go on and go to work, and I do my thing, and I come home, and I find myself like I'm in the kitchen, and I'm pouring a drink, and I'm drinking that sucker down, and I can't wait for the second one. And so there you have it. The first one is I'm drinking entirely for the effect, and I cannot wait to get the second one because I know it's going to take the second one to get me where I need to be. And I go, okay, so tomorrow, I won't drink tomorrow. And so I get up the next day, and I go to work, and I come home, and I am feeling like 40 miles of wolf shit while this is going on, I want to tell you. I am not happy camper anymore, and I'm drinking to maintain. Now, I don't know about maintenance drinking, but I'm drinking on a daily basis, and I come home. I'm not drinking during work, so I don't really think I have that serious of a problem. And yet, I can't control it. And I say, I'm not going to drink again today. And sure enough, I go right into that kitchen, I pour myself a drink, and I'm off to the races again. And I'm going to bed, and I'm passing out. And then somewhere between midnight and 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm waking back up, and I don't have sense enough to get up and take a drink like I hear some of you guys did. I wasn't that smart. I laid there in sheer craziness for a couple hours. And I had hallucinations, and I had all kinds of craziness going on. And that went on for a while. And one of these nights, I just got struck sober. I don't know how it happened. I had this sort of panoramic vision of my life going down the tubes, and everybody that I ever thought I loved, knew, and wanted to love was going to be gone, and life as I knew it. And I think I was having a near-death experience, or maybe a near-life experience. I'm not sure what it was. I know it was enough for me to go to work the next day and ask Vicki to please take me to a meeting. And I don't know why that happened, because I hadn't planned on asking her to do anything of that sort, and I didn't want anything about what she was doing. And yet, I went in there and asked her, would she take me to a meeting? So we went the very next day. And that's when my life began, really, is when I walked into these rooms. And I didn't have another drink, and I've not had another drink since the very first time I walked in the rooms. Now, I did pick up a little marijuana maintenance because I didn't have a program. I had no recovery. I was sober. So, you know, there's a friend of mine up in Sandusky, Ohio, and he talks about in his home group, and he says, in my home group, we don't smoke alcohol, we don't shoot alcohol, we don't snort alcohol, and we don't drink alcohol in order to have a good standing in your sobriety. And I stand on that as well, because I've tried to, best of my ability, not to take a drink or a drug to alter how I think, feel, or believe. And that has been my experience. Now, it didn't come overnight, because it took me 2.5 years sitting around in these rooms, occupying a seat in the back of the room with my little dark rosy glasses on, like John Lennon, thinking I was hip, slick, and cool, and I'm just not getting anything, and I don't really see that there's a problem here. And that's a dangerous place to be, but people were just gathering around me every day a little bit more. And someone would come to the island and speak, and it was utterly amazing to me that you didn't have any female alcoholics back then. I didn't know where there weren't a lot, and they certainly weren't talking at conferences. So the conference that was to come up on the island had all these men's names on it, and so I said, that's it. I'm done. I'm over it. I'm not going. I don't want to hear anymore. And so I didn't go to that conference. And little would I know that Michael was a female and she spoke. Now, the men in the room and the old-timers just took me under their wings, and they just put up with my craziness. And they said, Viv, after this conference, which I did not attend, they literally, and there were tapes back then, Tom Dooley was a dear, dear old man. He was an old-timer, and He was a fighter at one point. But anyway, he came in the room, and I'd been complaining about there's no female speakers that really, you know, to speak of, and I'm over it. And he literally threw this tape at me, and I caught it in midair. I was amazed. And I put it in my car, and I began to listen to this tape. Now, you know, God does for us what we can't do for ourselves. And that day, when I put that tape in that car, even though our circumstances were totally different, even though we lived in different places and did different things, there was something about the message that she carried that opened my soul. She broke my soul open. And I'll forever be grateful for that woman, because that was the first time I could identify with another alcoholic. And something weird happened. And a few, like, months down the road, she was to come back to the island to do another smaller little, you know, like a little talk for a bunch of us. And Tom Dooley said, "Ked, you're going to be her hostess." And I said, "Okay." I didn't have any other plans that day anyway, so I said, "Okay." So I didn't know I was supposed to do anything. And you know, now, please, you know, let me remind you of something. When you're a newcomer, you really don't know anything. Although you think you might look like you know something, I didn't know anything. And I really didn't like who I was, where I was, and what I was doing, but I was just showing up. And so Tom just says, "You're going to be your hostess." Well, I didn't know that required something. Like, you were supposed to go there and be of service. I didn't know how to do that, so I didn't do any of that. So when Michael walked in that day to speak, I was to introduce her. And, you know, and I met her at the door, and I said, "Hi, I'm your hostess." And she said, "Oh, really?" And so, anyway, I was to sit with Michael. I knew to do that, and we had breakfast, and you know, and she said, "So do you have a sponsor?" And I said, "I'm thinking about it." bad comeback. You don't ever want to do that if you don't want to do something around here. And she must have said it about 14 more times before that day was over. And she left me about 6 cards and said, "Call her." And, you know, and when you start opening yourself up to this program and you start showing up, amazing things start to happen. And in that time frame, something kept gnawing at me, "Call her, just call her." And I went, "No, she lives so far away. And I don't know about all this." And wah, 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 wah. And so, and that crazy mind is still active. And I don't know, I just got to a point one day, and it wasn't that I had any great God in my life, because I was pretty pissed off at God. So something was operating in my life. And I picked up the phone and I called Michael, fully expecting, "No, honey, I live so far, you know, we'll, whatever." And she said to me, "Yes." And by the time I had gotten to Michael, after 2.5 years of sitting in the rooms and not drinking, and now the marijuana's not working for me, and I'm ready to kill myself on a moment-to-moment basis, and I'm devising ways to do that, and all of this is happening. And Michael says, "I've met a man in the rooms who was talking about the 4-step, and he became, for our group back where we're from, known as the 4-step guru back then." And I'd never even heard. Now, I know in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 4-step had to have been mentioned once or twice. I don't know where I was. And so I was just utterly amazed that this man was talking. And if, I guess because finally I'm not doing anything and I have a moment of clarity, I'm beginning to hear the message. And it seemed to me that that 4-step was rather important. And so I was sitting in a room at a meeting, and as usual, being, you know, disrespectful and not meaning to be, but I just was. I didn't know you're supposed to sit still at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, not get up and down and go. Back then they smoked cigarettes and they, you know, get coffee, and I have 1 hour to perhaps save my measly little what's left of my life. And I'm thinking about coffee and this and that and the laundry list and that outfit and what you've got on, oof, and whatever. Grateful I didn't have to look like that when I got, you know, and I'm just making all these comparisons and I'm dying on the inside. And I get up to go get yet another cup of coffee because it seems like it's really important at the time that I have another cup of coffee because one really simply was never enough of anything. And so I go in the kitchen and I literally physically ran right into Dick, flatline, and I look up to him and I fully intended to say to him, Dick, I'm sorry. And out of my mouth came, Dick, will you help me with my fourth step? And I sort of sidestepped for a minute, like, who just said that? And where did that come from? And he knew me and knew what I'd been up to a little bit. And he said, yes. As a matter of fact, when this meeting is over, we're going to go over here to this little pew that we have that we've done a lot of little third step prayers on, and I've taken many of people there myself, and we said that third step prayer. Now I've already put down the substance. I'm stone cold sober. I have nothing going through my head but sheer insanity, and now Dick's telling me things. He's going through the big book and he's saying, this is what we need to do, you need to read the book. And I did that, and I don't know why or how that happened. And next thing I know, he's giving me instructions, and he says, you're going to say the third step prayer. You're going to go home, and you're going to make a list. And you're going to put down everybody in your life that you can possibly think. And he says, by the way, don't think. We don't need your thinking. Your best thinking got you here. Why don't you, just for the first time in your life, turn your will and your life over to the care of God you don't even like or know or understand, and let God give you that list. So he said, just put down everybody you think that pissed you off. And I said, well, that won't take long. And so I went home. He says, all you're required to do here is say the third step prayer, ask God to direct your thinking, and please deliver the names to you that need to be on this fourth step list. And I decided, oh, why not? I had nothing better to do that day. I went home and did that, and I was utterly amazed. Within about 20 minutes, I had over 100 names on my list of people I hadn't thought about since the first grade. And I was really pissed off a lot. So I had a lot of names on there. And I went back to Dick, and I called him up, and I said, you won't believe what happened. He says, I know exactly what happened. Because when I did the same thing that you just did, I got 1,500 names on my list. I'm like, Jesus Christ, I'm glad I'm not as crazy as you are. And so he would become my four-step guru, and he would take me all the way through. So by the time I met Michael, I'm sitting on this fourth step, and it's a really bad place to be. But anyway, so I hooked up with Michael. I go on up to Augusta. She asked me to come up to Augusta. Now, Michael's afraid of flying, and I'm afraid of going to foreign places I've never been before by myself. And this particular day, I forgot to bring a gun with me, and I'm flipping out. And any other time, I would have gone into a pawn shop and just picked up one. But there wasn't a store between me and her for 3 hours. And I got there unaided and insane. And she took me in and just loved me up and said, we're going to do this whenever. I think we did it the next day. And I just stayed there. And I learned some things about Michael that really just drew me in, and somehow she knew exactly and precisely what to do every single second. And it just, like I said, it just broke my soul open, just enough that God could get in there and I could begin to participate in my recovery. And so we went through the list of all the stuff, you know, all the dirty scuttlebutt, and all the things and the dirty deeds and the injuries and the harms done to others, and you know, and I just, there wasn't anything left off of that list that I'm aware of, and I began to look at that. It's almost like Chuck C with a new pair of glasses. I could see what I couldn't see before, and I was just done. I was shattered. The truth just about killed me. And I didn't want to live like that anymore. And Michael said, when we got to that fifth step and we began to go down the list, one of the names on that list was, of course, everybody in my family. and pretty much everybody I'd ever met. And I'll tell you a little way how not to do your amends. Because before I hooked up with Michael, I had someone that we did, I had the same list, I took to Michael, and she said, just go down the list and just start making amends. And I said, well, how do you do that? You just go in there and tell them, you know, you're sorry, and you know, to have a little conversation with them. But there were really no instructions. So I started at the mall, and I started going from store to store because all those people in there had pissed me off one time or another about whether things were on sale or not on sale, or if they were rude to me or not rude to me, and I just told them all about it. And I got these looks like, you know, I had three heads. You're crazy. We don't know what you're talking about. They didn't ask me to leave. They were glad for me to go. And so that was my first experience. I don't recommend you do that. I had no guidance whatsoever. On the other hand, Michael sat there and gave me explicit instructions on how to make these amends. And by the time I got through step five, we did. She said, I don't trust you to go home and do six and seven. You're going to do that here while you're here. And she was right, because I probably wouldn't have done it anytime real soon. There was no time frame in my mind. And then we got on to step eight, which I pulled directly from step four under her guideline. And that meant that everybody on that list, step four, was going to have an amends made in step nine. And the one that was the most difficult one for me to do was God, who I had absolutely turned my back on for many years. And I just felt that that was a punishing God. I wanted no part of that. I felt that throughout parochial school. I just felt I was in abject fear through school. And after school, and I lived with that, and I understand now what that was about, and that was no God in my life. And the God that would allow all of these disastrous, horrible, tragic things to happen, I wanted no part of. And Michael would begin to tell me that in God's world, if it's good, it's of God, and if it's not good, it's not of God. And I began to hear these small little slogans that made such a difference and were the absolute truth for me. And thank God I began to hear those things. But what happened for me was, the first one on the list was God. The second one was my daughter. Of course, all my family members were on there. And my daughter was, oh my God, when I had my daughter, I can tell you that I wanted her with every fiber of my being. I prayed about her. I studied how to do the chromosome thing. I went to talk to doctors. I talked to anybody that would help me. I wanted to make a girl, and I was going to make it happen. And we sure enough had exactly what I wanted, a perfect, perfect little beautiful baby girl, blue eyes, blonde, 5 pounds, 5 ounces. It was amazing, and I couldn't have been more blessed. And take that fast forward, the same little girl that I wanted desperately, and that family desperately, I would turn my back and walk away from one day. Just like there was nothing wrong with what I was up to. Broke their hearts. Broken hearts of little children, warped lives of blameless children, it talks about in the big book. And I couldn't see it then, but I could see it so clearly when Michael and I were talking about it. And what happened was, one day I went to pick her up, and so often there towards the end of my drinking, I would go pick them up when I still lived in Columbia. I would try to make it. And all too often I'd end up at a bar and have a couple of drinks so that I could muster up the courage to go look them in the eyes, which I couldn't do any longer. And I couldn't get there. And then on Christmases, I'd go to try to go shopping, and I would try to get some presents lined up. And towards the end there, the last few years, I couldn't even muster up that. I couldn't even show up for them. I couldn't be present for them anymore. It was killing me to look at them, and I couldn't drink enough to drown that pain. So one day that I managed to get it together to go pick up my kids. My son couldn't go because he was going to be in a little softball game, but my little girl got in the car with me, and she was so glad to see me because for once I actually showed up. And we had a car accident that day, and she died in that accident. And I had been drinking, and of course I'd been doing other things that day. I was also in the hospital, and I had the last rites that day too, and I don't know. I remember being in that hospital in the operating room, and I was literally standing. I was like up in the suspended up in the corner, and I was watching them operate on me. And I remember having this amazing feeling. And I also remember this vision of being on a cloud with my daughter. And we're just sitting there, and we weren't communicating like I'm talking right now, but we were absolutely communicating in a way that I could understand. And she said to me, "Mom, you can't stay here." And I said, "Honey, I don't want to leave you." And but I knew that I had to leave. She said, "Mom, you have to go back." And so I did, and I came back, and it was a long, long road of recovery, and I ended up facing manslaughter charges. And I want to tell you, I started drinking with a vengeance after that, and for 18 years I didn't draw a sober breath, not day or night. If I was awake or conscious, I was drunk, and I was trying to blot out everything, the misery of my life as it was then. And when Michael said to me, when I looked at that accident, and the dam broke, was, she said, "Vivian, that wasn't an accident. You caused that accident. The actions you took that day as a direct result of what you were doing caused that accident." And it's like I had no idea that that was what had happened. I'd lived into such denial for so long. And she said, "But here's what we're going to do. We're going to make an amends to your daughter." And I didn't know how we were going to do that. I literally, from that breath of that knowledge, at that moment, all I wanted to do was kill myself. Because all the shame and the guilt and the remorse of all the years and the days and the hours that I could have spent with them, I chose not to be there because alcohol was in front of all that. And so she said, we're going to walk through this together. You don't have to do any of this by yourself, and I'll tell you exactly what you're going to do. And she gave me every piece of information I needed, and she walked through me and with me when I finally was able to get to her. And she said, "We're going to go to the grave, and you're going to write a letter, and you're going to make an amends to her at the grave." And I had never been. I could not bring myself to go look at that area. I couldn't go by that area. And for 18 years, I never went there. I didn't want to talk about it. I didn't want to think about it. I didn't want to look at it. And there's no getting around it when you have to make those amends. And I knew it was somehow it was the right thing to do, and yet it was the last thing I wanted to do. So I drove to pick up Michael from where she was, and we were to she was to go with me and find the grave. Now, I'd never been there. I didn't know where it was. It was a Saturday. It was extremely hot. It was probably 110 degrees at the cemetery. There wasn't a leaf stirring. There wasn't a breeze blowing. There was nothing happening but profusely sweating. And we were looking for this little tiny plaque that said Katina Teresa Quattlebaum on it. And we found it. It took a little while. And we found her little plaque. And I stopped and got some flowers to take there, and I had a couple other little few things I wanted to bury there. And we just got there, and she said, "Vivian, all you have to do is read this letter." And so I read that letter as not only just a reminder of, but this was very powerful to me. I had a very powerful spiritual experience around this. Now, I'd already been having a couple, but I didn't know what they were, and I didn't understand any part of it, but now it makes perfect sense to me. And as I began to read this letter at the grave, Michael said to me, and at this particular time I had 4 years of sobriety, she said, "Vivian, all you have to do is bury your four-year chip here and you'll be fine." And I'm just going on autopilot because I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm in shock, and I'm just doing. And I bury my four-year chip there. And as I began to read the letter, an amazing thing started happening. I mean, it was a perfectly sunny, hot, very hot day, and both of us were sweating profusely. As I began to read this letter, an amazing wind just started to wrap around us and cool us off. Now my hair is standing back and Michael's hair is standing back, and I'm going, I'm so grateful you're here, because no one would believe that this is happening to me. And of course it's all about me. And so I'm standing there and I'm in such utter disbelief about what's happening here. And as that wind is engulfing us, we're cool. I'm not sweating anymore. I had gone down the path and started studying with shamans and medicine women and medicine men as a result of just being so crazy, totally over Catholicism, and organized religion just wasn't working for me. And so I started studying that, and for years I'd gone down that path. As I read this letter, an eagle was circling right over me the whole time I read this letter. And Michael sent me this little card sometime after the fact, and she said, eagle medicine, which must be earned, results in the reclaiming of one's personal power and soaring to new ways of being. And that's exactly what I was in the process of doing and didn't know. And the minute I stopped reading that letter, the wind stopped, the heat returned, and we started sweating again. And I remember looking to Michael in total just in disbelief of what I'm experiencing here. And I turned to her, and she's not looking like she's feeling too good, so I took her back to the car where the air conditioner was running so she could sit there. And something told me, go back. Just go back there and have communion with your daughter, which you've never done. And so I turned around after Michael got in the car, and I walked back and I sat down on the grave, and for the first time I could cry and grieve her loss. And not to mention the years and the joys that I wanted to share with her, and the things we could have shared and done together, you know, were just not going to happen. And I realized the finality of it all. And I'm just sitting there, and I'm beginning to just sob uncontrollably. And after a while, I'm quiet, and I'm just sitting there. I've already had this little spiritual experience over here, and now I take a deep breath, and my daughter talks to me, and she says, Mom, I have a life to live, and so do you. Now go on out there and live it. And I could not understand that for so long. And I didn't want to move, and I didn't want to breathe, and I didn't want to leave that place. Because I felt her presence so strongly, and I felt God's presence for the first time in my life. And for the first time in my life, I felt forgiveness. And so after a while, I continued to sit there, because now I'm just like glued in. I don't want to move. And this little ladybug lands on my skirt. And I always wear a little ladybug. In her memory, but this ladybug lands on my skirt, and my daughter says to me one more time, she says, Mom, that's my favorite little creature. And that was it. You know, no big deal. And it was a big deal for me, but it was nothing more of that. And then the next year I started a women's retreat called the Ladybug Retreat in her memory, for women to come. And as a direct result of that, I can't tell you how many phone calls and how many people I know that have gone through the same thing. I've had dads call me from coming out of jail that shook their babies to death. And I've had women who have gone to jail and been through men, all the same things I'd gone through, who felt the same that I felt. And somehow hooking up with these people, we could help one another in a way that nothing else could. And they're all just such a big part of my life today. And I have some ladybug flyers back here. Polly's going to be speaking there this year, and I hope you guys will come. And Carla's going to be speaking there, and we can't wait to have her come. And I would love for you girls to try to come and be a part of something for the greater good for all of us, you know, and participate in that. I want to read this letter to you. Dearest Tina, I'm so proud to tell you, but you probably already know that I've been sober in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm sorry it took me so long to take these actions. I want to make amends for my actions as an irresponsible, undependable, and absent mom. I am responsible for your death, and I'm eternally sorry. And I love you with all my heart, and I promise I will use this tragedy to help others and hopefully prevent other tragedies like this from happening. I embrace you, and I love you, Mom. And then shortly after, I got a beautiful poem from a friend of mine who is a big part of my life today. We speak frequently. And her little 15-month-old daughter died in a car accident with her as a result of her alcoholism. And she wrote this most beautiful poem about her daughter and my daughter, and I'd like to share that with you, and it's called, "There's a little 9-year-old girl up in the sky, and she holds my baby between her legs on a swing of silver lace clouds. Her arms clasp around her waist so she won't slip, and my baby's downy hair tickles her nose, but she keeps on singing sweet lullabies and tells her stories of ladybugs and fireflies. She tells her what it's like to go to school, something my baby never got to do, and she tells her she wasn't sure if Santa Claus was real. My baby seems to know what she means as she giggles and squeals, and then she spoke of her mom with the warmest sound, and the baby of mine, she looked around, and their eyes met, and they knew the same disease had brought them there. An illness so ugly it didn't cure, that their moms loved them so dearly and would have died in their place, and how they wished and prayed to see their faces just one more time, to smell their smell, to let them know that now they were well. The disease had retreated after quite a fight, and day at a time, they win this war. This little girl whispered into my baby's ears as they swung even higher into the clouds, and I know our mothers didn't want it this way. I hope they know we have each other and that it's okay." I love that poem. And it tells me, in all of this experience, that there is no death, that there's only life. I have found forgiveness, and I don't think that I don't think about it every day, and I came to Polly one day, and I said, "Polly, how do I ever get over this? Because every day I relive that accident." And she said, "Honey, you don't get over it, you just get through it." And one day at a time, I get to walk through it with dignity and grace. God's grace has brought me to you so that you could heal me, so that I could be of maximum service to those about me. And I am so very grateful that because of what you did for me, I was able to be there for my son when he needed what you gave to me. And he sent me a text this morning. He said, "Mom, I love you." And I wrote back and I said, "I love you with all my heart." And he says, "I love you more. Oh, my God." Not too long ago, and just have a couple more minutes. And not too long ago, I was really worried about Todd because he's a guy and he's doing his guy thing and his life is successful and he's doing everything in his life is perfect right now. He's living life large, and isn't that what our dreams is for our kids? And I have a beautiful grandson. His name is Dakota. And he's never seen me anything but just love him up. And I tell him every time I talk to him, I said, "Don't you ever forget, honey, you're more precious than rubies. Tell those kids you love them and say something fabulous every day for them. They need to hear it." And so I've been there for my son. And he had a daughter. And her name was Megan. And a few years ago, she was driving drunk home, coming from a party, and she was 4 points over the legal limit, and she ran out in front of a train. And she would lose her life. And the disease of alcoholism is a generational thing, and it touches every part of our lives. And my son is having a hard time dealing with that, and that's going to be his stuff. And that's something that he has to take. My job is just to love him with my whole heart, because I can now. I'm conscious. I'm awake, and I'm there for him no matter what, no matter when. And he knows that, and He came into this beautiful program, and he's done fabulous, and he's just getting out there doing what he's doing, and I'm just so proud of him. My grandson is doing great. He smoked a little marijuana cigarette not too long ago and went, oh, my God. So I told my son, I said, honey, forget about college. You better start saving for rehab. I'm afraid it's tragically true. But you know, what a gift. What a gift that we have found a way out. What a gift that we now have a life second to none that I never knew possible. What I could not understand, see, feel, hear, or believe, I now see, feel, hear, and believe, and I am usefully whole. And I want to thank you for allowing me to share my experience, strength, and hope with you. And thank you so much from the bottom of my heart.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.